Hello and welcome back to Let's Grow Girls, the podcast where we talk flowers, flowers and some more flowers.
I think that's what the listeners like, isn't it? Flowers. So today we are joined by Corrie of Dawn Creek Farm in all the way in California. So we've had to negotiate a big time difference for today's episode. So welcome, Corrie, all the way from Santa Cruz on the west coast of America.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, we're very excited to talk to you. We love zinnias and we know you are known for your zinnias. So we're very excited to have you on today to talk all things zinnias. How many times can we say zinnias in under a minute? So we thought it'd be great by just introducing you to the listeners, really, and getting a little bit of information about you. So I know you've recently moved to Santa Cruz from Sacramento last year. Would you like to tell us a little bit more about the farm that you've got up there?
Yeah, so we're in a little bit of a transitionary period. Not a little bit, a lot. A huge transition right now. So we were up in Sacramento. I don't really know how to get into this. We started our farm in Sacramento in 2016. Before that, well, I have kind of a long history of farming and gardening that led up until that point, which we can get into if you'd like.
Oh yeah, tell us more. We love it when our guests have got a proper gardening history.
Well, I don't know about proper.
I love that, great accent.
But let's see. So growing up, my mother has always had a garden overflowing with flowers, and my dad taught at the Center for Agroecology and Sustainable Food Systems here in Santa Cruz. So this is where I'm from. We moved back to my hometown. That is a 33-acre farm and garden that was started in the 60s by Alan Chadwick, which you may have heard of. I'm sure that people listening to this will have heard of Alan Chadwick. So my sister and I spent a lot of time growing up running around on the farm while my dad worked, and getting lost in the orchards. And when I went off to college, I immediately found my home at the UC Davis student farm, and I worked there through school. And I studied fine arts and plant biology and horticulture at university.
Oh, what a combination.
Yeah, it was, it felt very misunderstood at the time. You know, everyone in the fine arts department didn't know what I was doing in the sciences and vice versa. And I honestly didn't know. It's been a lifetime of understanding the way the different parts of myself weave together. But when I left home, I noticed pretty much immediately that my relationship with plants is what grounds me in a place. So moving to a new city, I immediately started learning the names of all the new plants I didn't recognize. And you know, walking down the street, I could be like, oh, hey, friend, good to see you. Good to see you. And so that's been a common thread throughout my life. But I think that leaving the mountain community that I grew up in and going off to a new place was when I really started to tap into how deeply my relationship with plants is a part of my life and my health. And that has continued to this day and deepened in many ways. So after school, my soon-to-be husband and we met working at the student farm, Toby, and I. And he started a timber framing apprenticeship back in Santa Cruz. So over the last 15 years, we've kind of bounced back and forth between the Central Valley and Santa Cruz here on the coast. And so after graduating, we moved back here. I got a job working at a local ranch growing their veggies and herbs. And when we got married in 2014, I was able to grow the flowers for our wedding there. And that's when I started getting interested in flower production in addition to vegetables. And at the same time, I had a textile business and a small seed company selling natural dye seeds, growing natural dye plants and gathering the seeds. And I started my first kind of amateur foray into plant breeding at that time. I started selecting my own strain of Japanese indigo plants for increased dye potential, basically, plants that produce more pigment. Oh. Mm-hmm. So through that work, I got a scholarship to attend a series of plant breeding classes with Sally Fox in the Keipe Valley. She is an incredible breeder of cotton. She has bred a series of naturally colored cotton strains where she took, for decades she's been doing this. She took natural land race cotton. So cotton is native to Central and South America and Africa, and in the wild grows in a whole range of colors, browns and tans and pinks and greens. We just know the white. But the reason that we know the white is because it was the easiest to dye. So when textiles started to be industrialized, the white cotton was bred to have a long enough staple length to be processed by modern machinery. And all of these landrace cottons were kind of left behind. So she started taking those cottons and breeding them for a longer and longer staple length, which is the length of the individual fibers produced by the cotton plant, to the point where they could be processed by mills here in the United States. And it turns out these cottons are just incredible. They're naturally fire resistant, they're antibacterial, they're beautiful, a beautiful range of colors. So that's been her life's work, and working with her through the series of classes that she offered really gave me a window into, wow, like plant breeding, the relationship between plants and humans is incredible and rich and diverse. And it was the first chance that I got a window to see how it could be made into a lifelong relationship with a group of plants. And that was very inspiring. So fast forward a few.
It sounds like you found your calling almost. Like this isn't just a love. Yeah. This is a vocation.
Exactly. It's a very deep well of potential, I think, is what I felt at that time. And I wasn't sure how it was going to apply in my life. But fast forward a few years, we were able to purchase property in Sacramento and start our own farm. And that's when I started to, form a relationship with floral designers. We sold every stem wholesale to florists. And just start to see the gaps, start to see, I think that this is maybe where my visual arts background has really come in handy or enriched my farming experience, is that working with floral designers who are artists and who appreciate the nuance of color and form and shape and texture really helped me start to see the potential in the market, the potential in the plants that we were growing, and selecting flowers that I knew would just thrive in when they were sent off to this artistic environment. I'm like, I love you. I appreciate your beauty and energy. And I know that there are other people who are going to appreciate you too. So that's the segue, I think, into where I am now with the breeding.
I like that. It's like the same kind of pride you have for your kids.
It's absolutely.
Not that I have kids, but like when you send them off to school and you're like, I know they're going to love you. Absolutely. Off you go and be wonderful.
Absolutely, absolutely. And where I am now, with the zinnias, after years of working with them and the last 2 years sending the seed out into the world, I see all of these people who are getting so excited about them, forming their own relationships with them, and I feel like that pride for sure, but more of just like this joy at seeing this relationship that has been so formative for me now getting to go out into the world and bring joy and healing and do its thing, form other relationships. And
I mean, it's amazing, isn't it? Because to take your analogy, Sarah, of like you're sending your kids off into the world, but most people have 1, 2, 3, maybe there's a few like big families out there, but you are sending like hundreds of thousands of your babies out into the world and touching so many more people, right? I know you've had like you say a couple of years of sending them out into the world, but there's more than one child, they're out there.
It's a pretty phenomenal scale.
Because, and also you're not getting Instagram tags of people's kids, are you? You're getting them of the pretty zinnias, so right. That's got to be much more fulfilling to see to see those, isn't it? So you moved up to, back up to Santa Cruz last year, did you
yes,
say?
Yeah, last fall.
And is that to be closer to family or?
I mean, in essence, it's complex. I think that part of it is to be closer to family for sure. In 2020, all of our lives got turned upside down. But for
Didn't
me, my personal journey through that year was deeply traumatic. I had just had my first child. I gave birth to our son in the fall of 2019. All of this pressure mm-hmm. started falling upon local farms to respond with product. Mm-hmm. It was our busiest, most stressful spring that we'd had to date. And just mm-hmm. after Mother's Day, my health started deteriorating. And it wasn't clear, you know, it had started before then, but that's when it really took a turn for the worst. And it's a long and winding story, but in essence, I had contracted a very severe case of a soil-borne illness. Yeah, I held on to my life by a thread that year and managed to make it through. I was really fortunate. You know, the hospitals and infectious disease doctors in our country were just completely overwhelmed during that time. And I'm fortunate to have a number of family and friends in the medical field who helped me advocate for myself and eventually figure out what was going on so I could get the appropriate treatment. So I went through several hospitalizations and pretty intensive treatment during that time. Our farm was carried through by, we had three incredible women who were working with us at that time. One in particular is my dear friend Tamara, and she basically took the reins of the production and sales that year and kept our farm going through the fall and managed to get a succession of my zinnias planted. And
well, she sounds like an amazing
friend.
Yeah, she
really is. Yeah. Can't, I don't even have words.
And how are you doing now?
So essentially, I mean, there's a lot of parts of the story, I think, that apply to our conversation ultimately. I did turn a corner, and I was told by my doctors that since I was susceptible to this illness and it's endemic to the Central Valley, that staying and working with the soil there, I would always be at risk for the rest of my life of getting sick again. And so I'm still in recovery. It's been a very long, I'm kind of in a chronic stage of the recovery at this point, doing much, much better, but it's a long
I'm
road.
Glad to hear
yeah,
that.
Thank you. Yeah. So at that point, it was clear, you know, I couldn't get out of bed. I couldn't keep running our farm and we couldn't stay. So
Well, it sounds like it's kind of non-negotiable for you not to have something to do with the ground and what grows in it. So
absolutely.
You've got to do what you had to do what you had to do, right?
Yeah. And I think that ultimately I do feel like I have a lot to work through this whole experience, and I feel like it feels like the stage that I'm in is, you know, you're a caterpillar and at some point it's time to change form, but before you become a butterfly, you basically go into this chrysalis and turn into this enzymatic soup in order to reform.
And you're
I'm soup. I feel like
I love this. I think I'm soup too. Can we just start a club in the corner?
Absolutely.
I also feel like soup.
Yes. Yes. So many aspects of identity dissolve. I mean, it's also in a way it's like a death of who you were before. And I really wonder how many times are we rebirthed in our lives in a new form? For me, this is a very extreme.
You are very deep, Corey, and I am here for it.
Very wise.
Very wise, yeah. I mean, it must be, you know, we were going off on that tangent. We said we love a tangent here at Let's Grow Girls. But I imagine it must be like almost like a form of PTSD or something, because you've been through such a traumatic event. You know, it takes some time to get over, but that's not that I'm saying it will completely heal you, but, you know, being in the garden with the things you love, doing what you love, is so important, isn't it, when you've been through an experience
Absolutely.
Like this?
And I feel like with the zinnias, you know, I mentioned that Tamara was able to get, with the help of our other two incredible women, Katie and Karen, who were helping during that time, they managed to get a succession of my breeding program planted out that year. And, you know, I could spend maybe 15 minutes out of bed during that time, and I would go out to the flowers and I would mark the ones that I wanted us to select for, and spending that time with them and the magic of it, the zinnia magic, which I would love to talk about because I feel like they are really special plants in that regard, really helped me through that time in my life. It gave me energy where I had none. You know, any little shreds of energy that I had after healing were going to raising our infant son, you know, and giving that love to him. And so I really found in my relationship with those plants, I found it was giving me life that I could share.
Joy.
Yeah. Joy.
That is amazing. Yeah. That is
something to look forward to, hope, you know. I was, you know, I was making selections going, I don't know if I'm going to be here next year to see this, but I can hope.
Yeah. Well, and now I can just imagine you moving with them. Like, in my imagination, it's like you with a suitcase and then just a truckload of zinnia seeds. I imagine that's what you move to your new place is like. Just a little...
It was that, and it was also an entire moving van full of living zinnia plants in pots and crates.
Oh,
yes.
Oh, I love this.
Yeah.
How many living plants?
I don't even know, but it was, I believe it was a 20-foot moving van.
Oh, wow.
You know, it also had my roses and everything, and we did have to make a couple trips, but, but yeah, it was, just with the timing of our move, which was in late summer.
It's got to be done. It's got to be done.
Yeah.
My, I dread the day when we have to move and everything has to come with us as well. It's, you can't leave them behind.
I'm facing a move in the next month or so. And I actually now have gathered all of my actual belongings into a room. And the amount of belongings that are mine and the amount of plants I have are just vastly... Like, I'm like, I'm going to need a big van, but like... I bought all of these storage bags for my clothes in IKEA, these like massive storage bags, and I only filled one. But I have like a whole, like my garden is all ceramic pots with like peonies and perennials, and I can't leave any of them. And I've got house plants and I'm just like, what have I done?
Yeah.
So yeah, I can relate to that.
Crazy plant lady club right here. So moving on to the zinnias, I feel like we've got to ask the most important question first. Why zinnias? How? Why? I mean, obviously, what we know, but, you know, tell us.
I am so glad you asked that question. I mean, talk about another deep well for me. So I think that a lot of people, and maybe this is, I think this is changing, but I'm sure that some people listening, I know this was definitely me years ago, had this idea of zinnias as being kind of a pedestrian flower, something that shows up every year in bright colors and six packs in the nursery, and they're annuals, you just grab them and go, they give you a bright spot of color in the garden, they're sturdy, and all of those things are true. But what I think that the potential that they have is just phenomenally vast. So in my experience with them energetically, you know, as a plant friend, they are incredibly generous. They are very light-hearted plants. I believe in flower essences, which if there's anyone listening to your podcast who's into flower essences, zinnias are kind of the totem of curiosity and childlike play and a sense of humor.
I've never heard of plant essences before, but I need to know more about it.
Well, there's a really lovely podcast called the Flower Essence Podcast. That might be a great place to start.
Oh, another one for the list. Where we're going next. Make a note.
Oh my god. Best day ever. Sorry, carry on.
And so I found all of that to be true. I also feel like in terms of a relationship between plants and people, zinnias are really excited to work with us. They are like ready to be friends. they're ready to be propagated. They're easy to start from seed. They're also easy to start from cuttings. They grow quickly. They fill up the garden with their beautiful colors. And their color potential is actually infinite. What we see in the nurseries are these bright colors because that's what catches people's attention when they're walking down the rows of plants. But the zinnia gene pool is, it feels to me at this point, I'm 7 years into my love relationship with them, it feels to me that it's infinite. They are willing to show up in pretty much any color maybe besides blue. At least in my experience.
Blue's the unicorn, right. Isn't it, of flowers?
But maybe even that's debatable. And also flower form.
Do you know, listening to you talk about them, like, I feel like you're talking about them like they're like a species of human or something. Like you really feel that deep connection with them, and I absolutely love it.
Yeah, well, you know, I think that I'm really excited to see this whole new wave of people getting interested in seed saving and plant breeding, because I think that, at least here in the United States, my sense is that many gardeners have become somewhat separated from the full yearly cycle of our relationship with our garden plants, in that, you know, they get to the end of the growing season and then they sit down in the winter and they order all of their seeds from catalogs. And that's a fun ritual in itself, right? You know, you're flipping through the seed catalogs and getting excited about what to grow. But it means that somebody else is growing your seeds. And when we start saving our own seeds and we get to observe these plants over generations, it really does become a relationship. It's like a back and forth conversation. So when I talk about them, I really do feel like I'm talking about friends, because I have spent so much time in that exchange, you know, walking down the rows, seeing who's bloomed, what new surprises are there, getting to appreciate them, getting to make selections, isolate them, pollinate them by hand or with the help of pollinators, and then wonder like at the potential for next year and see it come to fruition. It's really a magical process.
I think it's an amazing journey that you've been on, and I love that how they just sort of grabbed you. Like, there wasn't, it sounds like there was no other flower that you were going to start breeding with.
Well, I would say that I do breed other flowers.
I know, but like, this one was going to be the one.
For sure. Yeah.
I imagine that you get started and then you get hooked. You're thinking like, oh, what else can I breed
for
here?
Sure. And I mean, I think that zinnias really do shine because of their affinity for growth and how quickly they mature. So especially, you know, where we were in the Central Valley, I don't know the degrees in Celsius, but the temperatures there regularly reach over 90 degrees starting in April. So it is very hot.
Warm.
And zinnias thrive in that environment. One of the things that And they also can grow in cooler environments, you know, they're very adaptable. But when you get into that heat situation, they bloom incredibly fast. And then the seeds mature very, very fast. So from a breeding perspective, it is really incredible. You can get multiple generations of breeding into a single growing season, versus many other plants, you can maybe get two generations if you're really pushing it, or if you're doing greenhouse growing. But with zinnias, it's just like this incredibly fast process where you get to see, you know, within, as soon as you plant the seeds, within maybe 2.5 months, you're already seeing the results of your crosses and selections. So I think that, yeah, it's That's very exciting. Exciting. And I think it's a really wonderful place for anybody who is interested in this, who's listening to me talk and getting excited about the possibilities of starting their own breeding adventure. Zinnias are a perfect place to start.
I think so. I mean, I can't remember what order our episodes are coming out in, so apologies if this is a spoiler for somebody. But we spoke to a chap about peonies last week in our world, but who knows what that is when the podcast actually comes out. He said it, you know, it takes 7 years plus to even get to see the peony that you tried to cross because of all the intricacies of peony breeding. So zinnias sound like much more instant reward for the hard work that you're doing. And you know, and I with people and how impatient they are these days, I think it's a great place to start with.
Absolutely. I think that zinnias are very on trend in that regard. You know, they're hip with how quickly our media moves these days. They're ready to rise to the challenge of catching people's attention.
They are. So if, like, let's go back a little bit and talk about how to start zinnias. So, you know, there's, I think sometimes they get a bit of a reputation as being a slightly finicky seed to start. As in, I always hear, oh, don't start them in trays because they don't like their roots to be disturbed and all that kind of stuff. But, like, how would you start the seeds? What do you think is the best way to get them going?
Let's see. I would put a disclaimer in that I don't exactly know your growing climate, like how much cooler you are than we are here. I mean, here on, now that we're...
So we're not massively cooler. I think we're probably quite similar to what you are in Santa Cruz. Yeah. So, I mean, obviously, I'm speaking generically for the whole of the UK. But I am trusting Google with its centigrade to Fahrenheit conversions.
I can confirm that in the north of the UK, we are colder. And the zinnias, they do not like it here. I have tried it. They will grow in a tunnel. If I try them outside of the tunnel, they're a bit stroppy.
Yeah, for sure. They are definitely heat lovers, and cool temperatures, especially cool, humid temperatures, I think really can dramatically slow their growth. And make them.
That's relatable. Yeah. I kind of feel the same, to be honest, about the weather up here. I'm like, this is really slowing my personal growth. Like, do you mind?
So I would say our spring, so sort of like April time, we're looking at about 15 Celsius, which is about 59 Fahrenheit. And then at the moment, Sarah, I'm really sorry because I know this is not anywhere near your temperature, but today we had a whopping 86. Wow. It is scorching.
What's
this year,
in...
I don't know if you heard.
Celsius.
That is 30 degrees we had today.
Ah, it was 21 here.
So you had about
mediocre.
69, so quite a difference.
Yeah.
But like this year, and you know, we briefly chatted about sort of climate change, and this year where I live, previous hottest temperature was a few years ago, but this year we hit a disgusting 108 degrees Fahrenheit, 42 degrees, which is like unheard of. Like it fried everything pretty much. It actually fried my zinnias. Can you believe it? I had a tray of zinnias and those things did not live through this heat wave.
Yeah, I mean, I think
I didn't water them
enough. Well, there's that, but also I think that there's something to be said for, you know, the swing in temperatures, and if you are generally having cooler temperatures and then have this huge spike, even the heat lovers are going to struggle.
They just panic, don't they? You know, it's I mean, I panicked, never mind the flowers. I was like laying in front of a fan wishing it to go away by the time it got to that kind of level of heat. So I don't blame the zinnias for giving up.
Well, I mean, we don't really think about it, right? But us and our bodies and plants in theirs, are constantly adjusting to our environment to keep us comfortable. And so we come up with this whole intricate, you know, exchange between the environment, and then suddenly it changes to something extreme. The whole system doesn't know what to do.
Everything just
that
gives
being
up.
Said, though, I you mentioned that maybe zinnias don't do well getting stressed out in trays, and I would offer that I have brought zinnias in trays to the brink of death. You know, just completely yellow and devoid of nutrients. Pinched them back and planted them out and had them come back. And it does take a little while, but it is shocking to see those new leaves come out of what I think most people would have tossed. So I think that they may be more resilient than many people would think. I do start them all in trays. We start them indoors 6 weeks before our plant out date, our target plant out date, because they do, once they germinate, grow fairly quickly. And so we start them in trays on heat mats at 75 degrees Fahrenheit. And in that situation, for me, germination generally takes, you know, maybe 5 days, 7 days to get going, sometimes even quicker if the seed is fresh. I think...
Have you ever tried them in soil blocks, or are you a seed tray girl all
You know, I'm a seed tray girl. I'm still using the seed trays that I purchased before soil blocks really have had their day, and I'm committed to using that those plastics until I can't anymore.
No, yeah. I get it. I'm also doing half and half, because I can't give up the, I don't want to throw the plastic away, basically.
Yeah, so I do start in trays. Something just flitted through my mind there, but I think I...
What kind of size are the trays?
72 cell is what we have here. Okay. And I use something called a 72 deep, so you get a little bit more soil in there. I think that if you don't have access to that, then maybe a 50 cell tray would be best. So, you know, when starting seeds, the target is that the plant will germinate, start to grow, and as soon as those little roots reach the edges of the cell or the soil block, it's time to move them into their next environment. And if you don't, then the roots will just keep growing inside that cell and use up everything they possibly can from the soil. So zinnias do that incredibly quickly, which is maybe also why people talk about not wanting to start them in trays. And so, you know, when we're starting your warm summer annuals, I think, you know, it's generally, unless you get really excited and start them a few months before you want your last frost, then typically we would be starting things like maybe 8 weeks before our last frost date. But with zinnias, we wait until 6 weeks before, just to make sure that they're getting out of the trays as soon as possible.
Yeah, because some plants can deal with a bit of the roots being a bit bound, can't they? But zinnias don't want anything to do with that, do they?
They actually can be fine, and that's what I meant by bringing them to the brink of death. They can recover. and I do feel like they're very resilient in that way, at least in my experience growing in a warmer climate than the north. but you know, for any plant to thrive, you would try and avoid that situation.
So we've got our little seedlings now. They're doing well. The frost date has passed. Are we doing anything special to the soil that we're putting them in, or anything that you would recommend to get the ground ready, or are we just whacking those babies in?
So in my experience, if you have a soil test done on your garden and you amend according to that, so you're aware of whatever inherent deficiencies you have in your soil, or if there's anything you have in excess that needs to be addressed. You know, generally when you have a soil test done here in the United States, they'll give you recommendations for how to address those things. If you take care of all of that, I personally don't feel like zinnias need anything special. They are native to dry, rocky areas. And are very good at extracting what they need from the soil. If you're in a habit of regularly fertilizing your garden, compost they'll love, might as well, right? But if you're in the habit of fertilizing your garden, I would be careful not to give them too much nitrogen. So select a fertilizer or amendments that are relatively low in nitrogen. And that is because zinnias will respond to excess nitrogen by creating a lot of vegetative growth. And that means you get less air circulation, you get less flowers, more leaves, more disease potential because there's less of air flowing through your plants. And also you can get something called nitrate burn on the leaves. So the way that zinnias deal with excess nitrogen salts is that they store them in the tips of their leaves, and then the leaves start to turn crispy on the tips. So if you see that,
happening,
that would be the first thing that I would check for is
not in my garden, but you know, on the Facebook groups and stuff. Why is my zinnia looking crispy on the edges?
That would be the first thing I would check, would be some sort of either salt or nitrogen, nitrate excess.
And how close do you plant them?
So for cutting, and in our climate, which is rather arid, we space 9 inches on center. For breeding, I will actually move them even closer because oftentimes early
jam them in
because when you're starting new selections from cross-pollinations, you get a lot of off types that you are going to be removing or culling from the planting, and so the tighter spacing by the time you've removed all the plants that didn't match your goals for that planting, they'll have quite a bit more room. If you have room in your garden to space them 12 to 18 inches, they will really thrive. And if you're not going to be cutting them, they can end up blooming over a longer period of time because they're not focused on competing for nutrients with their neighbors. Yeah, right.
They're friends.
And then, so when you plant them, I'm assuming do you pinch them as you plant them, or do you plant them and let them get a bit taller?
It depends on what stage they're at, when...
How long you've left them in the trays.
How long you've left them in the trays, yeah. As long as there are two solid nodes on the stem below the pinch, then I will pinch them.
Take the head off.
For breeding, I will leave them to set their first flower because I want to be able to see, like, is this something I want to keep? Also, what is the natural form, you know, growth form of this particular plant? Is it going to branch on its own? Is it going to require pinching? Or, you know, with a lot of the ones that I'm working with now, they will make 3 healthy nodes, and then they'll send up a long flower stem, and then they'll just start branching, which is right where I would want them to be if I were to pinch anyway. So that saves that.
Clever little inherently plants.
But if I pinch immediately, then I won't know necessarily what it was going to do.
And you said something earlier that I didn't know, but obviously now when I heard you say it, I thought, duh, why didn't I think of that myself? That you propagate from cuttings, which essentially is pinching, isn't it? You know, can you propagate from the pinch?
Absolutely.
Tip?
And my motto is don't toss the tips.
You need that on a t-shirt, Corey.
Yeah.
Yeah. I love it. Do you know Sarah? We should be making a note of all these one-liners our guests come out with, and coming out with our own t-shirt range at some point.
I would buy that one.
Look, Sarah's making a note there.
I am actually going to write that down. I like them because most of them have a kind of like vaguely rude undertone, if you think about it.
Yeah.
I enjoy that.
Yeah. So zinnias root incredibly quickly from cuttings, and actually, you know, if you observe your plants in the garden, anytime a stalk, you know, falls over and touches the ground, they create what's called adventitious roots. So not only are they easy to root in general, but they will actually create, like tomatoes, they can create roots from anywhere on the stem, whereas many plants, you basically are only getting roots forming around what were in leaf nodes. So they just want to be propagated.
Right? And I feel like I can feel, you know, those like memes that go around that are like, you know, bloom where you're bloom where you're planted. Like, I can kind of feel a very nerdy one about this. Like, you know, get knocked over, grow some advantageous
roots. Absolutely.
Back up you go. I mean, I'm working on the phrasing.
Yes. I want to hear the final.
That's like a bumper sticker, never mind a t-shirt.
Hey, I said a meme, all right?
Okay, we'll go with the meme. So when you do it, are you do they prefer propagation in soil then with the tips, or can they
you can do water? Absolutely. Yeah. Ooh. They were better in water.
So you could be propagating as you're flower arranging. I love a plant that can do that.
Absolutely. Yeah. I would say if you are wanting to propagate in water, make sure you remove the flower bud, because the energy that's there in the stem will go into opening the flower instead of creating the roots. But if you remove that, then they can absolutely start in water. I root them in a mix of cocoa peat, perlite, and vermiculite. But you can really do, you know, a lot of people I know just use straight peat for their propagations. Zinnias will absolutely work in that regard. And they can root in as little as 10 days, which is incredible. You know, they're not just root, they can fill out a cell and be ready to harden off and plant out in the ground. So if you're growing zinnias from commercial seed and you're generally getting the flowers that you expected when you planted the seed, then there might not be as many reasons to propagate from cuttings. However, because you can, you know, grow the seed in a short amount of time too. But if you are breeding, or if you are just walking through your garden and you notice a really exceptional flower, rooting cuttings is a way to make, you know, in as little as 2 weeks, more of that very special plant to save seeds from or just enjoy for yourself.
So my brain is whirring here as you're talking. Obviously, I know about the bees and the job that they do with pollination and mixing up the colours and what have you. If I propagate from the plant, am I going to get the same color
exactly
flower?
The same. Yeah, genetically identical.
Oh my goodness, that's like a revelation. I love that idea that it's gonna, I mean, obviously we've got to protect the flowers to stop pollination further down the line if we want to collect the seeds, but we can essentially bump up the stock and have more seeds
this
more
also
quickly.
Means you could see a zinnia in someone else's garden.
Yes.
And be like, hello,
snip.
You are coming home with me.
Yes, absolutely. And I'm just thinking, you know, as we're talking, there are some very popular varieties on the market now. For example, I'm just thinking of the Queen Lime series, where you have a pretty unpredictable variation in how double the flowers are. For example, Queen Lime Red is, you tend to get a very large percentage of semi-double or single flowers, when most people are growing them for the very lush doubles. So even if you're growing for cut flower production and you want the doubles, then you do a planting. You can take cuttings of just those plants and use those for your next succession that year. You have all doubles.
I have...
She's a genius, Sarah.
No, but this is one of my later questions, because there are all these, like, mother's tales about double and single zinnias, right? Like, everyone on the internet is like, if you plant them upside down and sing a song, then you're more likely to get doubles. Or, like, if they get too cold, then they'll be singles. And if you don't, if you plant
too
close together.
Yeah, or feed them with seaweed, not this, or, you know, plant them in the moon of the waning harvest moon, or some, you know, you hear all this random stuff, don't you, about how this person magically got all of the doubles.
And you're telling me there a trick? it was predisposed at the seed stage whether or not they were going to be a double.
It is. I mean, I wouldn't discount the power of the waning moon.
Oh no, she's going to start talking about the harvest moon. She's going to start
but
that speaks to your deep well.
I'm open to anything, really. In my experience and my understanding, what you will find is that there are some plants that will genetically produce double flowers even when stressed. the other ones that you're getting in these mixes. I mean, another thing that shows up is the Cinderella series. You know, people complain about starting out the season and they'll get that beautiful mm-hmm. pincushion, but then later on in the plant's growth, it will start throwing single flowers. And that may be a sign of stress for those plants. But even in that same environment, if you're growing a large enough percentage of them, mm-hmm. you will find that there are plants that do not revert even later in the season. Those plants are the truly, mm-hmm. Truly double form, or the true form that you thought you were getting when you planted the seed.
I'm just chuckling because I'm thinking about all these people planting out by moonlight.
I mean, again, I'm not going to discount that, the magic of that. I'm just going to offer my observations and...
there is a whole like mm-hmm. subsection of gardening that's all moon related. Absolutely. I can't remember what it's called, but
yeah,
there's
I have heard that. Mm,
and it'll tell you like when to plant, because like it's to do with the tides, yeah. and like sometimes the moon energy is pulling up, and yes. that's when you should plant things that go up. I don't know. And then when it's going down, you should be planting like tuberous root veg seed.
Yes.
See, I am basically a witch.
Yes.
Maybe that's what I'll do next month. I'm going to convert to the moon gardening.
So I do believe in the power of that. And I would say that one of my kind of guiding forces in my relationship yeah. with the world is to never think that I know all of the forces that are acting upon us at any given time. and so,
yeah. Very
so I would say that there are a set of tricks that I can offer you, if you are someone who's going after, say, the very double bloom, mm-hmm. Is knowing that the single flower trait is dominant in zinnias, which means that, and that's because it's the easiest for pollinators mm-hmm. to visit and pollinate and cross-pollinate. It's kind of like the baseline design of the flower in its wild form mm-hmm. is those just a single or maybe double whorl of ray petals, and then the rest of the inflorescence is these disc flowers. Same with sunflowers. And so what happens is those flowers are the easiest to be pollinated. It's a dominant gene. The pollinators visit them more often. And they produce more seed in a commercial seed production situation than the double flowers. Because the double flowers are not producing a whole lot of their own pollen. The petals mm-hmm. pack tightly together, so pollinators are having to squeeze in there to get pollen to the pistils. So when you have a mix that you purchased that was supposed to be, you know, I'm just gonna keep using the Queen Red Lime because I feel like I see that come up in conversation a lot here, that people are unhappy with how many single flowers they get. So from a production standpoint, the seed producers want a certain number of single and semi-double flowers in the seed production fields to produce the pollen needed to get a good seed crop. So they are not growing a full field of just double flowers. It would be really cost prohibitive. They are growing that mix, and that's what you get when you grow the seed out. If you get a packet of that seed and you spread it out on the table, you will see that there are several different seed shapes. I don't know if I can describe this exactly verbally. Maybe I can send you to a friend's Instagram where she's done a lot of picture comparisons. I'll finish with that. So you will see that there are seeds that are kind of mm-hmm. oval shaped and flat. Those are the disc flower seeds. Single flowers produce mm-hmm. a lot more of those seeds. Then you will see the ray flower seeds, which are kind of like, they're long, they have a ridge, they're kind of wrinkled looking, they're kind of rough in texture. And those are the ray petal seeds. And so if you look, and you'll see among those seeds that there's a wide version and there's a very skinny version of that type of seed. The skinny version comes from the center of a fully double flower, because as the petals form, you know, they bloom on the outside of the flower and then gradually they develop towards the center. Mm. So those seeds that were connected to ray petals, which is what we think of as the petal of the zinnia, as they become more and more packed together close to the center of the flower, the seed that they're producing becomes squeezed. you know, by that tightly, those tightly packed petals. Whereas when they opened on the outside of the flower, they had more room to spread out, you get wide seeds. So, going back to our packet of seed, if you spread out your queen lime red mix on the table and you pick out only those very skinny ray petal seeds, then what you're getting is you are having a much higher plant of this, much higher chance of that seed coming from a fully double bloom, which means that one of the seed parents was fully double and it should contain those genetics in the seed. If you plant the disc seeds or if you plant the wider seeds, they have a higher chance of either coming from a single flower or semi-double flower or being pollinated by one of those or both. So your chances of it being a double bloom decrease significantly. And this came to my attention actually through a Japanese zinnia breeder study that was published years ago, where he found that if you are seed producing double blooms, a way to increase the number of doubles that your customer gets is once you harvest your seed crop, you filter out all the disc seeds and the wider shaped ray seeds, and you offer these skinny ray flower seeds from the center of double blooms to your customers. Of course, the Japanese figured this out, right? then you have a higher chance of them blooming double and pleasing the people who are growing your seeds. So yeah. That was a lot, and it's hard to describe it without the visual, but I hope that helps. Yeah.
No, I'm absolutely blown away by that. That has just blown me away. I wish the listeners could see our faces because the two of us are like, whoa.
I just mentally decided to buy twice as much seed next year so I can just ditch the stuff that's not going to work for me.
Well, I've got a few packets of zinnia seeds downstairs, and I'm going to go and...
Yeah, and this overlaps, you know, what I just explained might be confusing for people who have started diving into zinnia breeding, but I would just suggest trying it yourself and seeing what you get and learning from that. Yeah.
Have a bit of fun with it. And one kind of last question on the breeding, although maybe it might be a two-parter. Mm. Pollinating, obviously you want pollinating, but you want to pollinate the ones that you want, right? So are you pollinating undercover mostly, or did you, maybe that's where you are now, but did you,
yeah,
do you
bag, I mean,
them?
There's a range. Like, how I do all you, of those things.
Are you hand-pollinating? I'm just so interested in all of it.
Let's say I'm starting with a brand new and exciting flower that I found. So, like, if someone's walking through their garden and they go, oh my gosh, I've been keeping my eye on this bloom, it's really special. What I will do in that case is I will take our organza bags. I like to use the 6x9 inch, you know, organza jewelry bags that you can get online, and I will bag several of those.
eBay is our friend for these things. Yes.
Right. Yeah. So I like to take this new plant and I will bag maybe half of the blooms before they open, you know, when they're still in the bud stage, and that will give me a chance to have seed that is most likely self-pollinated. And I'm just trying to think how to, maybe I shouldn't go into everything, I'll just keep it simple. So I like to, when I find a new plant, isolate some of the blooms and get self-pollinated seed and leave some open to the bees to see, like, how does this plant play well with others. In addition to that, some zinnias are easily self-fertile, and other strains, and this can all be within this genus, Zinnia elegans, which is like the typical garden zinnia, you will find that some strains naturally self-pollinate, and others have self-incompatibility mechanisms, which means that if I were to isolate the whole plant to itself, not do a lot of hand pollinating, then I would get very little seed from that plant, even though it looks like the flower has gone through and it dries down. When you go to harvest the seed, you find that there's not actually any viable seed in the seed head. So if I really like a special plant, I will bag some of the flowers to self-pollinate, and I will leave some open on the chance that I can get those genetics, whatever phenotype phenotype that I liked about it, the color, the shape, the growth form, that will show up in the next generation, even if it's open pollinated or cross pollinated with other plants.
And do you use a paintbrush when you're hand pollinating?
Yes. So hand pollinating a paintbrush, you can just go to the craft store and, you know, get maybe 50, because you don't want to use the same paintbrush between...
Oh, because you don't want to mix them.
Yeah, exactly. You need to clean them in between. Oh, the other thing, let me just say this. Okay, so from the pollination perspective, another reason to bag blooms is that if you are wanting to cross-pollinate between flowers, you need to protect the pollen from being taken away by the bees. So they will very efficiently go through your patch and take all the pollen out of the flowers, and you'll go to do your hand pollinating and there's really not a lot there to work with. Mm. If you bag the blooms, you'll see just oodles of pollen that's there to work with. So even if you're not wanting to save seed from a particular flower, but you want to use it to cross, make sure you bag those blooms so you get the pollen.
Oh, that's interesting. I didn't think about it that way, because you're not going to want it from every plant, are you? Like, right at the beginning of the episode, we were saying how your kind of creative background as well has identified the gaps in the market. And I have to tell you that I'm absolutely gutted that we cannot get hold of your seeds here, because there is nowhere here that sells them in those shades. They are incredible. I don't know how you found those blushy pinks, but they need to come to the UK at some point.
Well, the story of that is on my website, so we don't have time to go over it now, but you're welcome to go there to find out the story. Yeah, I would say that start saving your own seed, and you may be surprised at how quickly those colors show up for you.
We could end up with some blushy pinks ourselves.
Yeah, well, so I started with the original, like, great-great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmother of what is now my breeding program was one special plant that showed up in a sea of mixes. So I did have a slight advantage in that I saw what I wanted and could move from there. But zinnias cross so readily that I wouldn't put it past you to grow a pink zinnia and cross-pollinate it with a white zinnia and discover some pretty cool things in between.
That's top of next year's list. I actually think if I was going to breed something, I'd breed a dahlia, but the zinnias sound like where I need to start for some instant gratification on the perfect variety. I'm all for a pink flower.
Yeah, you know, the thing about, I mean, zinnias versus dahlias. Zinnias have much simpler genetics. Many of them are diploid, where I think dahlias are octoploid. And essentially that means that with a diploid plant, it's a lot easier to predict the outcomes. I will say that. with the dahlias, you just get a whole bag. You never know what's coming out. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. You never know what's coming out of one of those seeds. So just a couple more questions, so slightly stepping away from the breeding. Obviously, a lot of our listeners are growing for cut flowers. Do you have any tips on picking, when to pick, or how to pick?
Yeah, let's see. I think Erin at Florette just recently posted a really fantastic video on her Instagram, so I would direct people there for a visual example of how to pick. You definitely want to make sure that the stems below the flower head have stiffened up, that they're not wobbly. Cut deeply into the plant, because that'll encourage more blooms later on. It can be hard to do for some people. Really, really cut in there, but you will be rewarded quickly with more blooms and longer stems. One thing that I have seen over the last years is that people tend, and this also I think relates to our conversation about the double flowers, it takes time for a double flower to produce all of the petals to become double. And so if you pick the flower early on, it will look more single, or it will look more like a double bloom. I mean, like a semi-double bloom. If you leave those flowers on the plant, then they can continue to produce more and more and more. more petals. So something that looked really single in the beginning may end up turning into a full, lush double bloom if you just give it another, you know, 5 days to mature. Yeah, observe your plants. You know, maybe let the first bloom go. Just let it be and see what happens when it's allowed to go, finish its full cycle. You might be surprised.
So don't be too snip happy with them. Give them a chance is what we're saying. Because you don't want to pick a zinnia early anyway, do you? You can't pick it when it's in bud stage. It's got to be open and, like you say, not wobbling its head around all over the place.
Right. But even so, like, some will reach that stiffened stem stage very early in the bloom's development. So you may want to leave it even longer.
Ooh, let's see what happens.
We're doing the same question, I bet. And then I guess the final thing is pests. What are the main zinnia pests and how do we avoid them?
Oh, well, so I can't speak for anywhere besides where I've grown in California right now. But I think that, so right now my biggest contenders are larger pests. They're deer and gophers. And so, do you guys have gophers there?
No,
we don't. I'm absolutely fascinated by this idea of these gophers. We have, what you don't have in America is a mole.
We do have moles, and you know I have those too.
You've got moles. Somebody told us that you don't get moles in America. Another guest, didn't they? I haven't made that up, Sarah, have
I? They may not. You know, so yeah sure here's the thing. Oh. Here's the thing. So where I am in California, I'm in Central California, and we have moles and gophers. People in Northern California, Oregon, and Washington seem to have a much less chance of having them. At least gophers. You know, I know several people up in Washington who don't have gophers at all. So I think that
because I've seen rose growers who put their roses in a cage in the ground to stop the gophers from getting to the roots.
Yeah, they're voracious. I mean, for people who have them, they'll immediately know my woes. And for those who don't, gophers are these little rodents that tunnel underground and then, eat your plants from below. They'll just take the whole plant down into their burrow, and what was there yesterday, you got in the garden and it is completely gone with just a little mound of dirt.
Literally, they just suck them down. Like a computer game.
Exactly, it is. Yeah. So if, for those who do have gophers, if you can protect your plants with wire baskets or raised beds, then that's excellent. For me, I'm growing too many plants for that to be feasible, and I'm currently, I'm experimenting this year, because this is the first year that I've really had to contend with them, I'm experimenting with a pelleted castor bean oil application to the soil. And this is apparently... apparently it makes the soil taste and smell very bad to them. Ooh. So far, knock on wood, it seems to be working. So,
well, you got to try all the things, haven't you? If somebody says it works, got to give
sure.
it a go.
Well, yeah, and I definitely have a backup.
Where
plan.
On earth do you find something like that?
You know, I just ordered it online.
The internet. Yeah. Google, the internet is full of Amazon. Of marvelous things, isn't it? The things you can find on the internet.
So tell us your gopher backup plan.
So each time a plant blooms that I know, I would just be devastated if it got eaten. Mm-hmm. Instead of marking it with a flag, I will dig it up and either put it in a pot, or I have a couple of raised beds that are protected with hardware cloth, which is like a galvanized wire that I know I can transplant into and they won't get munched.
Gotta protect the special ones.
Exactly.
I am so glad we don't have gophers.
Yeah, that's miraculous. Do you guys have earwigs?
Yes.
Unfortunately, okay. We have the earwigs. Those disgusting things.
Okay, they do like zinnias.
Oh, do they?
Yeah. Yeah, actually, yes, they love those too. Yeah, cool. Maybe you'll start to notice them on your zinnias if you look closely. They particularly like them when they're small, you know, and the leaves are very tender. Same with slugs and snails and even little pill bugs, roly-polies. I don't know if you guys have those. We'll eat them when they're small. So I always start ours indoors protected in some way. Also, mice. Mice will dig the seeds up. and eat them. They will...
I think that happened last year to me in my polytunnel. Mm-hmm. I direct sowed some zinnias quite late on in the season and not one of them germinated. Yeah. And I found a little, like, some holes in the soil and I thought a mouse came, didn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, they will. And they will also eat the new sprouts before the true leaves come up. I've caught them red-handed munching them like, you know, little sunflower sprouts.
Outrageous.
Yeah. So I have heard from a number of people who have had trouble with direct sowing, and the immediate thought is that they didn't germinate. But I would say when they're just out there in the garden, they are so tasty, whether it's rodents or insects. When they're in that tiny stage, they're just delectable. So give them a head start.
So anything we can do to protect them indoors is the way forward.
Get them big enough so that if they get munched a little bit, they can recover. And if you really have a lot of trouble with slugs and earwigs, I would recommend either using Sluggo if it's just slugs and snails, or Sluggo Plus if you have earwigs, which I don't know if that's a product that you guys have there in the UK, but we definitely have it here.
So just before we move on to our very last question of the episode, I feel like if I don't ask this question, we'll get shot. But one thing I know that we definitely have in common with you, it's not a pest, but it's mildew.
Yeah, everyone wants to know about mildew,
Yes, everybody loves the zinnia mildew. Am I right in saying that it's airflow, poor airflow, that causes mildew?
So that can be huge in exacerbating the problem. So anything that spreads via spores, which mildew does, if there's not a lot of airflow, then the chances of it just taking over inside the plants is really high. I do know people who've had luck with spraying milk. If you Google, milk solution for mildew treatment, a number of recipes will come up. And I haven't tried this, but my understanding is that it changes the pH on the surface of the leaf and it makes it inhospitable for mildew to grow. So that's worth trying if mildew is really bad. For us, we don't have it really bad where we are. When we were doing cut flower production, I would sow multiple successions and just, you know, count on getting some mildew at the end of each of those successions and being ready to go on to a fresh planting.
Rip them out and the next,
which you need to plant, you know, some distance away if you can. Make some separation if you plant your first succession. Yeah, they'll just hop right over.
Oh, because the spores are still going to be in the ground, right?
Yeah, so airflow, I would look up the milk thing if it's really a challenge. And then also just give yourself some backup plants or backup successions so you can just let them go when they start going down.
I feel like the milk option is unexpected because I would feel like spraying milk on your plants would be how you got mildew.
Because it's white.
Yeah, I don't know. If you were to like sort of give me a quiz and be like, is this a problem or a solution? I would be like, no, don't do that. Don't do that.
I guess I would say that, disclaimer, I have not tried that, but I have seen it work for other people, allegedly.
We love a home remedy here. Like my earwig.
Oh my goodness. The things that Sarah did with those earwigs 2 years ago.
Tiny plastic bowls, and then you put soy sauce in the bottom, and then oil.
I've done that. That's brutal. So
it is a little brutal, but it was getting a bit obscene. Like where I was growing in this polytunnel, there was more earwigs than there was soil.
Oh my gosh.
Like if you left a tray on like the concrete paths, like a seed tray, the next day you'd lift it up and there would be hundreds under there. Like, there was just more earwigs than anything else. It was crazy.
Did you find that put a dent in your population, the soy sauce traps?
Look, all I will tell you is I got a fair few WhatsApp pictures of earwigs floating in soy sauce, if that.
Yeah.
So what it mostly did was I sort of put them around some of the key plants. I think actually diagnosing a wider problem is that polytunnel was built years and years ago and the soil hadn't been amended, and essentially I think it was just completely nutritionally devoid, and that was how they became so prevalent there. I don't think the soil was healthy, but it did at least, like, they were sort of round my favourite, they were round my dahlias and basically round my zinnias just to try and save the ones that they really liked. But it took the edge off. I mean, I didn't wipe them out, but I felt better because I was trying to do something.
For sure. You can always, you know, if they're attacking the blooms, like for me on the dahlias, they'll go straight for the new opening buds and they'll just munch all the ends of the petals. That's when I will just bag the whole bloom, you know, keep them out of there.
Yeah, so that was the solution. So they weren't eating the flowers, they were just sleeping in them. I did almost once eat an earwig because it had crawled out of the dahlias that were on my dining table.
I remember that.
Crawled onto my, I was eating a little chocolate bar. I think it was like a post-gardening treat.
I got the WhatsApp picture again of the foil of the chocolate bar with an earwig right next to it.
And luckily, because I don't always look at my chocolate when I'm eating it. And luckily, I looked down and there was an earwig on the chocolate. And so ever since then, I started bagging because they sleep in my flowers and then essentially would come home with me and I'd find them in the house. And I've got boundaries and earwigs in the house. Yeah. This is a firm boundary. We don't.
For sure.
We don't have those.
No.
Yeah, well, and you know, they're not, I mean, I feel like for me, the times that earwigs have been a problem are when there is some sort of shift in the environment that allows a population explosion. I mean, typically in the garden, they're also eating aphids, they're eating small, soft-bodied garden pests, so they're not, you know, they're not like a nemesis until they get out of balance.
Unless they're in your chocolate bar.
Well, I think that this might, I actually could carry on talking about zinnias and breeding all day. I am sure that you've got plenty to be getting on with in the garden at the moment. So we are getting to the final question of the episode, which is Sarah's absolute favourite.
I don't know if it's my favourite, it just happens to be my main job. But that question is, if you had one piece of advice sort of for the rest of the growing season for the listeners, what would it be?
Let's see. I would encourage people to try saving their own seed, especially if you're getting excited about zinnias. Like I said, zinnias are the place to start. If you're excited about roses, I can tell you that you can save your rose hips this fall and see the first bloom on your plants next year, which... You know, there's just so many things. If there's a plant in your garden that you have an affinity for and you're interested in starting a multi-generational relationship with those plants, then just give it a go. You know, it could totally turn your life around. It did for me.
Oh, I love that. Just start.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we're at the end of the episode and I know that our listeners are going to want to know where they can find you for more zinnia everything, basically. You are on Instagram and your Instagram handle is Dawn Creek Farm. Yeah, I got that right. And you also have a website.
Yes. Yeah, and you can find that if you go to our Instagram. It's right there.
Our link there.
In bio. Yeah.
Perfect.
And I would say I didn't get to mention this earlier, but I mean I did mention it and then I didn't get to follow through. I want to send people to my friend Tiffany's Instagram, where she's gotten into zinnia breeding over the last few years and is just a sponge for information. You know, she's combed through all of the deep dark holes of online zinnia breeding forums and is like bringing it forward in a way that is really digestible for people. She made a whole series of videos last year, everything from seed saving to breeding. So her Instagram is Loma Flower Farm, which is BLOMMA, Loma Flower Farm. So please make sure if you're looking for how-tos to check out her feed.
Well, I'm glad I'm already following her because that would be embarrassing if I wasn't, wouldn't it? But yes, she's, I watched avidly her kitchen paper towels with the zinnia seeds on them. I was there for it.
Yeah.
So, yes.
Great, I think. Yes.
But talking to you and hearing your love of the zinnias has just made me feel like really fired up to give it a go myself next year. So thank you for that. And thank you for your time today.
Yeah, thank
you. You've been really generous talking to us about all things zinnia and we have really loved chatting to you. So thank you so much for coming on today.
Thank you both.
It's outro time.
Thank you so much for listening and for your support. We are loving this season so far.
And we hope you are too. If you love the episode as much as we love doing it, then we would be so grateful if you left us a review wherever you listen to your podcasts.
You can also subscribe and You can find us on Instagram for more of our adventures at Let's Grow Girls Podcast.
We're really grateful having you here, listening to all of our interviews with our amazing guests. And we hope that you carry on enjoying the rest of the season.
See you next week. Bye.
Bye. You sounded really far away when you said that. You sat back.
Yeah, because I didn't want to shout at our people, you know.